Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Crime Scene Evidence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 7, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Skinner v. Switzer. The question in this case is whether a convicted state prisoner seeking DNA testing of crime scene evidence may assert that claim in a civil rights action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, or must instead do so in a petition for a writ of habeas corpus under 28 U.S.C. Section 2254. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held, by a vote of 6-3, that federal courts do have subject matter jurisdiction over convicted state prisoner Skinner's claim, and that Skinner's claim is cognizable in a civil rights action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Justice Ginsburg was joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Justices Kennedy and Alito. To discuss the case, we have Evan A. Young, who is an attorney in Texas. Mr. Young is counsel of record on an amicus brief in support of the respondent. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Young.
My name is Evan Young. I'm an attorney in practice in Texas, and I'm going to take a few minutes to discuss the Supreme Court's recent decision in Skinner v. Switzer. The case was argued on October 13, 2010. Shortly thereafter, I presented a podcast describing the oral argument. As I did then, I need to disclose now that although I intend to describe the case as objectively as I can, I was counsel of record for an amicus brief in support of the respondent. The respondent lost in a 6-3 opinion written by Justice Ginsburg. At stake was an interesting question in federal jurisdiction concerning the dividing line between civil rights actions under Section 1983 on the one hand and applications for a writ of habeas corpus on the other. Dry as that may sound, it turns out to be quite interesting, and the horrifying facts of the underlying murder case make it more interesting still. The question is this: if a convict, here a convicted murderer on death row, wants access to more DNA testing, which procedural pathway, if any, is open to him to try to get it, Section 1983 or habeas corpus? We now know the answer. Under the ruling announced on March 7th, convicted prisoners are not confined to habeas. Section 1983 is open to them under these circumstances. This is a win for prisoners, but Justice Ginsburg emphasized that it might not be too big of a win. We'll make sense of that ruling momentarily. First, a brief recap of the facts. After attending a New Year's Eve party in 1993, Twyla Busby returned to her home in Pampa, Texas. Shortly thereafter, she and her two sons were murdered with gratuitous, vicious, gruesome violence. Henry Skinner, the petitioner in the case just decided by the Supreme Court, was living with Twyla Busby at the time. He was convicted of the murders and sentenced to death. He asserts his innocence, although he does not deny that he was in the home while those murders were being committed. Nor does he deny having had the victim's blood on him when the police found him hours later in an ex-girlfriend's trailer where he had gone to hide. He has argued that the extreme amounts of alcohol and codeine he had earlier consumed rendered him unconscious at the time of the murders. He could not have awoken, he says, much less brutally killed three people. The blood got on him, he explained, when he eventually did awaken, discovered the crime, and examined the victims. Skinner believes that the real killer was Twyla Busby's now-dead uncle. As usual, the police obtained various physical evidence at the scene. What ultimately turned this case into one for the U.S. Supreme Court was that some, but not all of that evidence was tested for DNA. To be clear, all of it was available, and Skinner's attorney could have tested the various samples before trial. He chose not to do so, and explained that he feared that testing them would make things worse for Skinner by showing his guilt more conclusively. Instead, he hoped to help Skinner by arguing that the prosecution's failure to test those items showed a shoddy investigation. Skinner later, and unsuccessfully, argued that his counsel had been ineffective because of this decision. And although the state of Texas has a special law governing post-conviction access to DNA, that law requires several showings, including that the original lack of testing be not attributable to the prisoner. Skinner's lawyer's trial strategy was considered reasonable, and therefore the Texas courts did not allow Skinner access to the evidence. It is not uncommon for death row inmates, or for many other convicts, to assert innocence and argue that they will be vindicated by further DNA testing, testing of as-yet untested evidence, of newly discovered evidence, of already tested evidence but with more advanced technology than was previously available. In 2009, the Supreme Court considered a case from Alaska, District Attorney's Office versus Osborne, in which the court rejected any federal constitutional rule for substantive due process in the DNA access context. But Osborne left open the possibility that if a state adopts rules governing such access, a prisoner could bring a procedural due process challenge. But under habeas or Section 1983? Osborne didn't say, and that's where this case comes in. Skinner, the prisoner, successfully persuaded the court to allow him to use Section 1983. Why did he want that option? It's because habeas is so hard. It is heavily circumscribed by fierce time limits and requires federal courts to pay pretty remarkable deference to state court decisions. By contrast, Section 1983 does not have those features, certainly not to the same degree. But historically, the Supreme Court has had a hard time finding the dividing line. The actual text of Section 1983 does not appear to have any limits at all. It is a broadly worded civil rights cause of action, and to simplify, it allows vindication of any state-sponsored violation of the federal laws or Constitution. Under that reading, though, every habeas claim could be brought under Section 1983. After all, a habeas claim challenges the lawfulness of custody because that custody violates federal law, such as imprisonment after a constitutionally deficient trial. So the court started developing its case law to recognize that Congress could not have intended Section 1983 to be so expansive. Otherwise, all those very rigorous requirements for habeas corpus would be pretty laughable. To summarize, in cases like Prisor versus Rodriguez and Heck versus Humphrey, the court has held that when a prisoner seeks some relief that necessarily implies the invalidity of the sentence or the conviction, or spell speedier release, then the prisoner must proceed in habeas. That is what habeas is all about, to put it simply, getting people out of jail. So, suing because you think you were owed extra good time credits and should get out earlier? Habeas. Because you're actually innocent and want to be released? Habeas. How about if you don't want out, but you want money damages for wrongful conviction? Slightly harder, but still habeas, because that finding requires a conclusion that the conviction is invalid, even if you're willing to sit in jail. How about if your challenge is that the general procedures used to evaluate parole eligibility or getting good time credits are unconstitutional? Well, that's Section 1983, because even if those general procedures are unconstitutional, that doesn't mean that the prisoner bringing the challenge gets out any earlier. All of these, of course, are the cases the Supreme Court has actually decided over the years. And so here's the question in this case. Is a prisoner who wants DNA evidence because he thinks it will show his innocence on the habeas side or not? Switzer, the DA, said that that has to be habeas. Nobody wants DNA access except to undermine a conviction or a sentence. It's not for writing a novel. Skinner, by contrast, said that you can't look beyond the actual claim. It's like the good time credit procedures challenge, he says. Even if I get the DNA, it might not be of any use. Getting the DNA does not automatically get me out of jail. And the court agreed with Skinner. Even if he gets the DNA, Justice Ginsburg wrote, it may not be enough to clear him. Maybe it's slightly favorable, but not enough to get him out. Maybe it's inconclusive. Or maybe his trial lawyer was right all along, and it will actually further incriminate Skinner. The test is this. If he succeeds in getting the DNA before we even know what the DNA results are, would success in getting the DNA necessarily imply the invalidity of his conviction or sentence or necessarily spell speedy release? Of course not. After the results are in, the courts may examine them and decide whether Skinner was entitled to some relief. Winning at this round just means getting the DNA, not getting out of jail. So, the court said, this must be Section 1983. Fair enough. But isn't there something to that objection, that everybody knows why he wants the DNA evidence? Justice Ginsburg doesn't deny that he's hoping to use it to undermine his conviction. But she says, that's not the relevant inquiry now. There is no case saying that habeas must be the sole or even an available remedy where the actual relief sought at this moment would neither terminate custody, accelerate the future date of release from custody, nor reduce the level of custody. To those supporting Switzer, that may not be persuasive because it sounds a lot like praising artful pleading. Indeed, cleverly asking for something just shy of getting out was exactly what Switzer had hoped that this case would prohibit. DAs like Switzer are worried about prisoners finding ways to keep coming back to court for this reason or that reason in an effort to generate continual delays. Giving prisoners a guide to how to stay out of habeas is the worst outcome for most prosecutors. The new recipe seems to be ask for things that fall just short of getting out of jail until you have enough for a slam dunk. So the question then is this: won't this new decision just lead to a flood of post-conviction litigation under Section 1983? Again, Justice Ginsburg has an answer. There's no evidence for that, she said. Most of the circuits actually allowed this sort of action under Section 1983 already, and there appears to have been no flood, nor even a rainfall. And she warns that there had better not be one coming, either, because there are plenty of legal hurdles that block frivolous claims, like the Prison Litigation Reform Act, with its various ways of penalizing prisoners who file meritless suits. And she pointedly notes, Osborne made this particular claim, post-conviction access to DNA evidence, almost impossible in federal court as a substantive matter. That's a part of the opinion that seems calculated to deprive Skinner of comfort. Justice Ginsburg emphasized several times, in a relatively short opinion, that the court was in no way embracing his underlying claim. All the court was saying was that there was subject matter jurisdiction under Section 1983. On remand, she says, there will be time enough for the lower courts to consider all the other reasons why Skinner should lose. All that the court decided here was that one of those reasons must not be that Skinner can only proceed in habeas. Justice Ginsburg ended the introduction to her opinion with an ominous sentence. Osborne, she wrote, left slim room for the prisoner to show that the governing state law denies him procedural due process. Later, she reiterated the hurdles still facing Skinner, particularly, she wrote, the vitality of his claim in light of Osborne. Skinner may have won the technical right to go to federal court as a Section 1983 claimant, but the court said nothing that would stop Skinner from being quickly turned away on the merits once he arrives. This decision does not mean that he will ever get any more DNA evidence. It just means that he can try for it under Section 1983. Justice Ginsburg was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Scalia, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Thomas wrote a spirited dissent, joined by Justices Kennedy and Alito. Justice Thomas said that the court's approach lacked common sense. Seeking DNA evidence in Texas law after post-conviction proceedings have begun is simply part of the collateral review of a conviction. Habeas is the means to review every other part of a criminal conviction. Indeed, it is what habeas is all about. Justice Thomas wrote, there is no principled reason this court should refuse to allow Section 1983 suits to challenge part of this process, the trial proceedings, but bless the use of Section 1983 to challenge other parts. Justice Thomas was also worried about the federalism consequences of the majority's approach. The reason that Congress has restricted habeas so severely is because state courts and state law are entitled to respect, to comity. That explains the deadlines and the deference. Federal judges shouldn't be too quick to undermine state court criminal proceedings. But, Justice Thomas wrote, the majority provides a roadmap for any unsuccessful state habeas petitioner to relitigate his claim under Section 1983. After state habeas is denied, file a Section 1983 suit challenging the state habeas process rather than the result. What prisoner would not avail himself of this additional bite at the apple? Thus ended Justice Thomas's dissent. Let me mention one last aspect of the case that did not divide the court, the Rooker-Feldman arguments raised by the DA. The Rooker-Feldman doctrine says that because the only federal court that can hear an appeal from a state court judgment is the U.S. Supreme Court itself, a state court loser cannot file suit in a federal district court asking that lower federal court to undo the state court judgment. That would otherwise, in effect, give the federal district court appellate review over state courts, which, ironically enough, it effectively does have, but only in habeas. And so federal courts lack jurisdiction over such suits seeking appeals from state court judgments outside of habeas. The reason that Rooker-Feldman was invoked here was because Skinner used the Texas Post-Conviction DNA Access Statute to try to get the testing, and he lost. But he did not ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the judgment of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and that judgment became final. Then he filed this Section 1983 suit in federal court. To Switzer, that looked a lot like a backdoor appeal. Justice Ginsburg noted that it wasn't really until the oral argument at the Supreme Court that Skinner's counsel made clear that what was being challenged was not the judgment of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals or the behavior of the DA, but the statute itself, as construed by the state courts. That articulation may or may not survive scrutiny on remand. But Skinner's counsel was wise to argue something like it, because it safely removed Skinner from the clutches of Rooker-Feldman. It's okay, jurisdictionally at least, to challenge a statute or regulation in federal court. It's not okay to ask the federal court to redress a specific state court judgment that you don't like. Justice Ginsburg's discussion of Rooker-Feldman is the third instance in the past 6 or 7 years of the court continuing to explain how narrow that doctrine is, and the Rooker-Feldman discussion here may well find its way into the federal court's casebooks. None of the justices disagreed with her. Both the majority and the dissent are powerful and persuasive. The case was a hard one. Both parties presented solid briefing and solid oral arguments, which allowed the resulting opinions to be so good. On a sad note, one of those advocates, Greg Coleman, made his last argument in the U.S. Supreme Court in this case. His untimely death just before Thanksgiving robbed the court of many years of his advocacy. Coleman argued on behalf of Switzer, the DA. Those of us from Texas continue to miss him. Like his opponent, Rob Owen, who argued for Skinner, Coleman presented an outstanding argument that capped a remarkable career as an advocate. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.